This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, May 16th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, state lawmakers passed a slew of gun violence prevention bills this legislative session. We'll hear from the head of Colorado Ceasefire. A newly developed sponge can pull lead and other toxic metals out of water. That story and more in This Week in Water. And as we reach the end of the school year, we'll hear about a public health professor at Fort Lewis College who works to develop a two-way conversation with her students. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth. This week's KGNU Science Show previews the Gold Lab Symposium, which is taking place later this week on the CU Boulder campus. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of The Wit and Wisdom of Alan Watts. Time for the headlines with KGNU's John Kellen.
The state Supreme Court ruled yesterday that Colorado landlords must give people living in federally supported housing units 30 days' notice of an eviction. That ruling is being hailed as a victory for tenants' rights. The 30-day notice was originally part of the $2 trillion CARES Act, the COVID-19 economic relief package enacted by Congress in March 2020. That requirement did not have an expiration date. Colorado Politics reports that different judges around the country have reached different conclusions about whether the 30-day notice in a federal law should take priority over state laws with narrower eviction notice windows like Colorado's 10-day law. But State Supreme Court Justice Melissa Hart wrote in the court's opinion that an expiration date can't be inserted where Congress omitted one. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is taking action to prevent unreasonable foreclosures on Marshall Fire victims. HUD announced yesterday they're updating reverse mortgage foreclosure guidelines for people for home equity conversion mortgages following a natural disaster. NGU said it's wrong that people who lost their homes to the fire would also be at risk of foreclosure when they can't live in a house that's no longer there. HUD has identified all the properties in its servicing system in Louisville, Superior, and unincorporated Boulder County. With the updated guidelines, extra HUD approval will be required before due and payable actions are taken against homeowners who lost homes to the fire. The number of migrants coming to Denver appears to be leveling off, at least for the time being. KGNU's Colette Zarnicki explains.
Last week's sunsetting of the pandemic-related immigration restriction, known as Title 42, has prompted a new influx of migrants into Denver and other U.S. cities. An average of 250 migrants a day came to Denver last week, according to the city's Office of Emergency Management. But the city's migrant support dashboard says that over the weekend, that dropped to fewer than 130 a day. Still, city and state leaders call these sudden surges a humanitarian crisis. Title 42 allowed border authorities to cite pandemic concerns as a reason to send migrants back into Mexico, even if they had credible asylum claims that would have allowed them to legally remain in the United States. The end of the federally declared public health emergency last week ended Title 42, thereby uncorking a bottleneck of cases that had been in limbo. Emergency shelters in Denver have been overwhelmed, especially since the weather took a turn to consistent rainfall in the last week. For KGNU, I'm Colette Zarnicki.
Newly passed legislation that requires the Colorado Energy Office to study energy options could advance nuclear and other alternate energies in the state. The bill's sponsor, Republican State Senator Ron Pelton, says he thinks that nuclear energy in the form of small modular nuclear reactors are viable economic energy producers. Colorado Politics says it's an idea that's taking hold as part of a worldwide nuclear energy renaissance to decarbonize the world's electric power systems. House Bill 23-1247 easily passed the State House and Senate with bipartisan support. Governor Jared Polis has not yet signed it into law. The city of Boulder is launching an e-bike voucher program this summer. KGNU's Pam Johnson reports.
The city will make 200 vouchers for commuter e-bikes and cargo e-bikes available during the first distribution round in July to gauge interest in the program. According to the city website, they will likely have another round of vouchers in September. Residents of Boulder who applied for the program online will enter a random selection process. During the first round of vouchers, most will go to income-qualified applicants. City staff have not yet announced when or how residents can apply. As with Denver's program, Boulder will offer a higher voucher amount to residents who can prove economic need. The standard e-bike voucher will be $300, but qualifying low-income residents can receive a voucher of up to $1,200. The vouchers can only be used at participating bike shops. Details are available on the BoulderColorado.gov website. For KGNU, I'm Pam Johnson.
The City of Denver has unveiled a new anti-bike theft program. The 529 Garage System is a digital platform that replaces the Denver Police Department's current registration database. To participate, bike owners log on and enter the bike's serial number, make, and other information. All that rain from recent days is causing scattered flooding and road closures through the region. A portion of Coal Creek Canyon is closed, including State Highway 72 from Twin Spruce Road to Colorado 93 in Arvada. State transportation officials say it's likely to be an extended closure. Flooding has also closed roadways in parts of Adams County, including 26th Avenue between Yell Road and Wolf Creek Road, and Piggott Road from 80th to 88th Avenues. In Lafayette, Coal Creek Trail is also closed by flooding, including the underpass at South Public Road. The Colorado Department of Transportation reminds motorists to use caution, don't tailgate, be aware of emergency crews and vehicles, and to expect the unexpected. We could see more rain later today. The National Weather Service says there's a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the region, mainly after 3 o'clock this afternoon. They're calling for sunny skies this morning. Look for a high of 74 degrees in Boulder, 78 in Denver, 76 in Fort Collins, and 61 up in Nederland. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Lawmakers passed and Governor Jared Polis signed into law at least four major pieces of gun safety legislation this session. New laws include raising the minimum age to buy a firearm to 21 and an extreme risk or red flag law that expands those who can petition to keep guns from the hands of those deemed a risk to themselves or others. Joining me now live is Eileen McCarron, co-founder of Ceasefire Colorado and president of its Legislative Action Branch. Good morning.
Morning.
So can you give us a brief wrap-up of what all was accomplished and what maybe didn't get done this legislative session with regards to gun safety legislation?
Thank you, Shannon. Yeah, we did. As you mentioned, we have we established a minimum age for firearms purchase of 21. That's for both handguns and long guns. And also expanded the ERPO petitioners to include educators, healthcare and mental health care providers, and the attorney general and district attorneys. And a waiting period, so you have to wait 3 days, regardless of how quickly the background check clears. And that's a very important, both where it's providing a cooling off period for people who are angry with one another, or and also with suicide and prevention. Colorado is a very high suicide state, so this is an important aspect of addressing suicide. And then one that's so important, gets less attention, is the immunity repeal. The gun industry has enjoyed a liability protection for years, since 1986 in our state. And then in 2000, it was made so that if you did sue any member of the gun industry, you would lose and you would pay their attorney's fees. So we repealed that and established a cause of action for people to do lawsuits and the people who've been harmed, and also the attorney general of the state of Colorado can sue dealers, manufacturers, whomever, who are violating our laws or behaving in a manner that's dangerous to communities. There are also two other bills that are sitting on the governor's desk that we are watching, and we know the governor will support and sign the ghost guns ban, which bans self-manufactured guns. Largely, people get them in kits that are unserialized, so they evade background checks or they circumvent background checks, and also they're untraceable when recovered in a crime. That bill also deems that having what is called a machine gun device that create that turns a semi-automatic weapon into a machine gun. They're called auto sears. They, if you are in possession of one of those, it's deemed a dangerous weapon, and that's a felony. So that was added. And then there's just one that not many people were watching, but it moves, it makes municipal courts have to follow the same procedures as the county and district courts with regard to domestic violence. And there are a number of things on that in the domestic violence world, but the one we're interested in is that it requires relinquishment of firearms by domestic violence abusers. So those are still on tap for signature. What we didn't get done, as everybody noticed, is that the assault weapons did not get passed. And that was a disappointment for people in the gun violence prevention movement. But it was not an easy pathway to get all the way to the governor's desk and sign. So that wasn't totally surprising that it didn't pass, but it's the first time we've run that. So that was great. There was also one about that's relevant to people in Boulder that would have given county commissioners the power to, or the authority to prohibit discharges of firearms in densely populated areas. So you have a lot of people living in Boulder who are outside the city in unincorporated areas, but there are a lot of them, and it would have allowed the county commissioners to declare, not in this area, you can't do target shooting in your yard. There's been problems up in St. Mary's Glacier with a person who's got a 1/3 acre lot and firing against a tree all sorts of weapons. So that failed to make it through, and that was disappointing.
I want to ask a follow-up question about this 3-day background check or this 3-day wait period. Does that also apply to, for example, purchases of weapons at gun shows?
Yes, it would. That's right. So they'll have to make arrangements for how someone will pick up the firearm after it passes the 3-day waiting period.
I also wanted to ask about pushback to local laws. Now, I mean, we've been talking about the state legislative session and what did and did not pass at the legislature this session. But there's also been attempts at the local level in Superior, in Boulder County, in the city of Boulder, and a lot of the towns around here to instate their own prohibitions on assault weapons or so-called assault weapons. And there's been quite a bit of pushback to that. What do you see is the next logical phase with this?
Well, the pushback right now is in the form of lawsuits that have been filed by the Rocky Mountain gun owners. And I think the next phase of that is the resolution of those lawsuits, what's going to happen with regard to those lawsuits. I don't think expect to see any movement by other cities to enact assault weapons bans until they know what's going to happen there. I do want to point out something very, very important that your listeners. Firearms fatality rates. I'm going to say that again because it's so very important. States that have strong gun laws have lower firearm fatality rates. And for those who are statisticians or can remember the statistics classes they took, the correlation coefficient is 0.75, which is strong. That's a strong, categorized as a strong correlation. So it's important to know that as we address the gun violence in Colorado by enacting laws and different laws that we are making our state safer.
I'm going to have to leave it there. Eileen McCarron is co-founder of Colorado Ceasefire and president of its legislative action branch. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Shannon.
Up next is This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Getting the lead out with sponges. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It's been a hot, dry spring in Alberta, Canada, which has led to disaster. As of Saturday, there were 86 wildfires burning in the province, with about a third of them out of control. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced, and already this year, more than 1,800 square miles have been affected.
Smoke traveled all the way to the provinces of Ontario and Quebec, as well as reaching the U.S. East Coast, where it was blamed for turning the sunset bright orange in the Washington, D.C. area.
For a few days last week, there was relief from the high temperatures, but the forecast for May 14th in Western Canada and the U.S. Pacific Northwest was for a heat dome, a high-pressure system that extends up into the atmosphere, trapping warm air like a lid on a pot.
Temperatures in Portland, Oregon were predicted to be in the mid-90s and in the high 80s in Seattle, Washington. Climate Central, a group of independent scientists, has already determined that the forecasted heat dome has the clear fingerprints of climate change.
One of Alberta's main industries is fossil fuel production. However, as Clean Technica reports, there's been little discussion in the media about its connection to climate change and the fires.
In Alberta and neighboring Saskatchewan, temperatures have warmed by about 1.9 degrees Celsius since the mid-20th century, higher than the global average.
Early last month, the Environmental Protection Agency released a report showing that more than 9 million lead pipes currently deliver water to homes across the U.S.
Many cities like Detroit, Pittsburgh, and Denver are replacing those service lines, which is a lengthy and costly process. But there could be a short-term solution.
Scientists at Northwestern University have developed a new sponge coated with nanoparticles they say removes lead and other toxic metals, leaving drinkable water behind.
After cleaning contaminated tap water, they rinse the sponge with a slightly acidic solution to recover the lead, which could then be used where it's needed, say in batteries. The sponge could be reused with 90% of its effectiveness intact and could also capture other valuable metals like cobalt.
The sponge is cheap and could be commercially available. The scientists say it can be an easy-to-use tool in home water filters or even in large-scale environmental cleanups, for instance, to remove metals from mine spills like the one in Colorado that turned the Animas River bright orange 8 years ago.
If you were to dive underwater, you'd naturally hold your breath to stay down as long as possible. Many marine mammals do the same, but according to a new study, when hammerhead sharks want to spend time in the deep sea, they hold their gills.
Researchers from the University of Hawaii at Manoa wanted to understand how cold-blooded hammerheads that can't produce their own body heat were able to hunt in deep waters, where temperatures are similar to those in Kodiak, Alaska, without freezing to death.
Hammerheads and other fish use their gills as lungs to absorb dissolved oxygen in the water, but if the seawater they're taking in is cold, they'll get cold too.
That is, unless they shut their gills to maintain body temperature, which is what the team discovered hammerhead sharks were doing by equipping three of them with devices that measured their muscle temperature, depth, and activity levels.
They saw that the sharks' muscles stayed warm throughout their journeys into the deep, but suddenly cooled as they approached the surface, implying they were breathing again. The team found the hammerheads could shut their gills for 17 minutes on average, spending only 4 of those minutes feasting at the bottom.
The new insights could help to manage and conserve the species, which are increasingly vulnerable to changing ocean conditions and more to human activities near the ocean floor, such as deep sea mining.
And finally, maybe you're that unlucky person. The one mosquitoes devour at a barbecue while others go unbitten? Well, according to a new study, the reason might be your soap.
Contrary to the impression multiple bites might leave, mosquitoes don't live off people. They mostly feed on plant nectar. Female mosquitoes, however, will supplement with animal blood to produce eggs. So if you smell like a botanic garden after showering, you're a one-stop shop.
Researchers at Virginia Tech explored the relationship between soaps and the insects by exposing 4 volunteers to Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, which are vectors for numerous diseases.
The scientists had participants lather up with Dial, Dove, Native, and Simple Truth soaps, but also factored in the volunteers' natural odors, which can be influenced by everything from diet and lifestyle to products like laundry soap or deodorant.
Some volunteers were mosquito magnets from the get-go, but all soaps affected the extent of their appeal. Three of the four soaps increased mosquito attractiveness, while washing with the coconut-scented Native brand tended to repel the bugs.
Before you rush out to buy coconut everything, know that the study was very small. That said, the research could lead to developing future repellents that are plant-based, so mosquitoes will just buzz off and leave us alone.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
For many college professors, teaching involves relaying information to students through lecturing. But one public health professor at Fort Lewis College works to develop a two-way conversation with her students. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Clark Adamidis of KSJD and KSUT has more.
It's late April, and Professor Tapati Dutta is preparing students for final exams.
On a morning in 1975, a van bearing the blue and white logo of the World Health Organization on the door drives into a village center. Even I know that
she tells the story of a botched public health outreach effort by the World Health Organization. In the story, an outreach team visits a village in India. They arrive in a van with the organization's emblematic logo on the side, a snake coiling around a staff.
The villagers who have a fear and loathing of snakes regard the serpent van suspiciously. An angry murmur of astonishment passes through the gathered group of villagers when these men remove large mesh-covered cages from the vehicle, open the cages, and out flies a cloud of mosquitoes.
The story is Dutta's way of teaching the importance of community trust in public health.
So there have been several examples of such community backlash because of lack of community engagement.
In Dutta's class, she explores the middle ground between theory and practice through storytelling.
Public health talks a lot about doing things in a democratic way, equity, trustworthiness. There was a huge divide even between people who are working in the field and people who are in the academic world.
For Dutta, building trust in public health campaigns is important. Trust is equally important in her classroom. And as a teacher, she works just as hard at building a community as she does relaying information. Part of her strategy is to get to know students individually and incorporate the perspectives of the students into the coursework.
Once the trustworthy relationship is developed, like many students come and tell me their relationships with their grandparents, so that it is not that I am trying to learn something new or impose something new, but rather building on what already is there, what I am and what they are, and building on that towards a classroom community. So it is as simple as that.
Dr. Dutta says her teaching method draws on her upbringing in India and the traditional relationship between a guru and a student in that country.
They would all live with the guru in a place where everybody had to do their stuff themselves, from cleaning to washing to do everything. So that is the culture we grew up with.
Professor Dutta doesn't live with her students, but she frames coursework around the life experiences of students.
It is coming from the community and going to the community. I'm just a mere facilitator in the whole process.
One student finds similarities between this teaching method and her Navajo upbringing.
I'm hearing, especially from tribal elders, how they pass down the oral traditional knowledge. It was really engaging for me to really feel those emotions.
Camille Keith worked on a public health campaign with Dr. Dutta in the last few years. They translated COVID-19 vaccine information into Braille code and into the written Navajo language. The idea came from students brainstorming together in the classroom.
It took a process to do the translations, and a lot of research was involved too with identifying the different terminology, because Navajo language, it was very new, so there wasn't a lot of COVID language terminology out there.
Keith says Dr. Dutta's approach to teaching allowed her to combine academic work with her cultural background.
She really allowed me to take ownership of the project. although there was like some challenges and everything was not very pretty at times, but having a great mentor, it really helped tremendously. I really gained confidence in myself.
Dr. Tapati Dutta has been building community in each class at Fort Lewis College since 2019. She's currently working with Camille Keith on a journal article that will document this approach to teaching. For KSUT and KSJD, I'm Clark Adamitis.
That's it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host and producer, Shannon Young. Thanks to John Kellen, Colette Czarnicki, Pam Johnson, Alexis Kinyon, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin, and Clark Adamitis for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for How on Earth? That's all still ahead after these headlines from the BBC.